Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Undoubtedly, it was only a matter of time before the debate over same-sex marriage led to discussion about same-sex divorce. That's an issue here in Missouri, and we'll be talking about it with our legal roundtable panel on today's program. Also on our docket, a Jennifer Joyce subpoena that has journalists screaming foul, and is it too much of a stretch to call some municipal jails debtors' prisons? I'm Don Marsh. These stories and more on today's Legal Roundtable. Joining me in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Mark Smith is assistant vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. And also with us, Booker T. Shaw, partner at Thompson Coburn. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with us on a cold, cold day.
Hi.
Thank you.
Bill, I'd like to start with you, wearing two hats as you do, as a journalist, professor, and an attorney. To talk about this Jennifer Joyce subpoena, St. Louis Public Radio has received one, Post-Dispatch has, others have received. She wants materials, audio, visual, and initially notes on that raucous aldermanic hearing on the Civilian Review Board. What is your take on this? There are several concerns, aren't there not, on the part of journalists?
Yes, there are. I mean, journalists feel as though, in general, as though this kind of really broad subpoena sort of recruits reporters and journalists and photographers into the law enforcement activities, and it can impinge upon the news gathering of the journalists because pretty soon the people who are having their pictures taken or being interviewed are wondering whether or not that information is going to be going to the police and to the prosecuting attorney. So her initial subpoena was very broad. You know, as you said, audio, video, reporters' notes.
Now she recanted on that, did she?
She did recant on the notes. Actually, her initial subpoena, she went so far as to say that the news organizations should not report the fact that they had received the subpoena, which is something St. Louis Public Radio decided it would not abide by because she had no legal basis for asking for that. Reporters do not like to have their notes and their outtakes subpoenaed, and in this case it was a particularly, I think, hard to justify in that this was a public meeting where there were, I mean, it happened in with all sorts of witnesses there, so you know, one would think that it would be very easy for her to investigate whether there were any criminal violations given all the witnesses who were present.
And wasn't the city videotaping this
meeting? Yes, the city was videotaping.
There was plenty of access to
right.
video. So is this, Booker, is this a constitutional issue? Is this a freedom of the press issue?
Certainly. What happens is the subpoena was too broad. There was no indication that she had made any other efforts to look at what was available in the public record. Typically when these subpoenas are issued, there has been some discussion ahead of time. There has been some attempts to get the information otherwise, and that it's a last resort, in effect. And while no one doubts the prosecutor's integrity, sometimes I think diplomacy may be lacking.
And Bill, where does it stand right now? The subpoena has been issued, but?
I think there are still discussions going on between lawyers for the media organizations and the circuit attorney. So I think it's perhaps being negotiated.
So I'm going to take the other side and take Circuit Attorney Joyce's side on this one. I mean, first of all, as an attorney, any time you do discovery, you always ask for everything because that's just what you do. And then you negotiate from there. And second, it seems to me there's a difference between video that's taken in a public meeting where I don't think people have an expectation. If I come and talk to you as a journalist and I want to talk to you about a particular thing that happened and you're taping me, well, I think I have some expectation and I think that releasing that could hurt your ability to gain the news. But if it's just filming of a public meeting that other people are filming as well, and you're right, other people are filming it, but they might not have the angle. I mean, it seems crowded. I saw some of that stuff on TV. I couldn't tell what was happening. So I would want to see, it's like on football. You want to get just the right angle. Maybe you can see what happened. So I still understand that there would be a chilling effect. I guess I wasn't as worked up about it, though. And so, the, you know, in the St. Louis Public Radio, they're big boys. They can go and say, no, we don't want to do that, and then work
it
out.
Well, I guess, you know, when Mark talks about, you know, discovery, we're talking about an adversarial situation,
right?
So why create an adversarial situation when you don't talk with guys ahead of time? It may very well have been that they could have worked out something ahead of time where NPR and the Post-Dispatch would have been willing to say, well, let's take
true.
A look and we can give you this information.
But there is this other element, too, Bill, which you alluded to, and that is don't tell anybody that I'm doing this, that this call for secrecy in this thing. That adds another chapter to the story.
Right. I mean, that was just I think that was uncalled for because she didn't really have any statutory authority to ask for that. This all sort of brings in the discussion of something that's referred to as the shield laws. A lot of states have got shield laws that allow reporters to protect confidential sources. In most circumstances, Missouri doesn't have a shield law. Illinois does, but Missouri has a court decision. Has court decisions that sort of say that lay out some of the things that Booker was talking about. That, you know, first of all, the law enforcement officials should try to get the information on their own and only be trying to get this kind of information as a last resort.
So, Mark, do you want to revise your stance on
that? No, I'm not defending the keep it private, but I still think, I mean, you got to give it a try, and they're trying to get the stuff. Would it have worked better? I don't know the people involved, so I don't know. But, yeah, usually that works better.
Well, let's take a moment then to talk about the whole civilian review thing, which has been back and forth in the Board of Aldermen. Don't want to spend too much time on it, but the big hang-up, the major hang-up, as I understand it, seems to be the desire or lack thereof to have subpoena powers on the part of the Civilian Review Board. What's that all about, Mark?
Well, I think there are two issues. There's one, the political issue of who will, and I think, as I understand it, Mayor Slay has said he will not go along with a bill that provides for a subpoena power. The second issue is the legal issue. The Chris Koster, the Missouri Attorney General's office, has given an informal opinion saying they don't see any problem with under state law with a subpoena power, but the city councilor has said that there is a problem under the charter with an aldermanic committee creating a board that will report to a department, the Department of Public Safety, I believe, and the city charter doesn't allow to give them the subpoena power. So you get this legal issue and the political issue. The political issue is probably the bigger one.
So the subpoena power would be used, if it were in effect, on the part of the board to call witnesses in cases involving police and incidents involving
but
the police.
Bill,
that
but
were
Bill
under
was
review.
Saying beforehand that the committee, and I didn't realize this, the committee's not going to be hearing directly from the police officers. That's going to be done by the Internal Affairs Division. And they could hear from witnesses, but it sounds like it's very limited. I think people have in their mind that this board is going to just start subpoenaing police officers to come in and cross-examine them. And, you know, one, that's not what the bill says, apparently. And two, these officers have rights, just like everyone has rights.
Yeah, there seem to be some real limitations beyond the limitation of lacking subpoena power. I mean, I think a lot of civilian review boards are judged on the basis of do they have the subpoena power so that if push comes to shove, they can get the information for their investigation. But there are other limitations in this bill, at least appears to be the most recent bill, in that it says that the civilian oversight board members or their staff can sit in on internal affairs interviews with civilian witnesses, but they can't ask questions. They can suggest questions. They cannot sit in with the internal affairs and the interviews with the police. Mm. I mean, that's quite a restriction.
Sure. You know, Booker, just for the fun of it, I'm going to say I'll bet you Jennifer Joyce would go ahead with the subpoena power for the Civilian Review Board so that all of the information could be gathered during an investigation.
I don't know that would be true, Don. I think that she would likely have some concerns as well, particularly with regard to, as Bill was discussing here, these police department employees and police officers, because these investigations touch upon their employment, then there are privacy considerations there that the police officer have the right then to bring his attorney, and these kinds of things become very complicated. So I think we are probably going to end up with a bill, as it is reported out of committee, that does not give them subpoena power. The Public Safety Committee that the civilian board reports to does have that subpoena power. But as it stands right now, they cannot delegate that authority. That is, the Public Safety Committee and the Board of Aldermen cannot delegate that authority to the Civilian Review Board. And I don't think Jennifer would have any problem with that.
All right. Any other thoughts with regard to this?
I mean, I would think the prosecutor in the city of St. Louis is going to be very concerned because, as Booker said, that you've got the employee issue, but you also have sometimes people are saying this police officer committed a crime. And so then that police officer has constitutional rights like any criminal defendant. I would suspect if I were the prosecutor, I don't want some civilian review board mucking up the investigation, and then I have to prosecute for a crime after they've kind of screwed it up. And so I would think there would be real concerns on the part of the prosecutor.
Well, I think on that point that the bill provides that if there is a criminal investigation going forward, that then the civilian oversight board stops its investigation, and maybe internal affairs as well.
All right. Well, I want to get into this issue of same-sex divorce and the Alabama same-sex marriage case. We have to take a break. I'm going to take it a second or two early so that we can devote a little more time to that subject. We'll do that now. It's Legal Roundtable Day, and we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. As we continue our legal roundtable discussion, with me in studio is Mark Smith from Washington University, Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale. He's a journalism professor there. All these gentlemen are attorneys, by the way. And Booker T. Shaw of Thompson Coburn is with us. Now to this issue I think a lot of people are talking about and wondering about, and that is that the Missouri Supreme Court has kicked back to a lower court the case of same-sex divorce, getting away from marriage. One attorney put it, "The lower court has ruled that there's nothing valid to invalidate," referring to Missouri's gay marriage ban. "Therefore, this is not something that should happen here in the state of Missouri." What do you think, Booker?
Well, when I look at the Supreme Court decision in this case, it really is not telling us much of anything. The Supreme Court is simply saying that judges have jurisdiction over dissolution matters. And so for the trial court to simply say, "I have no jurisdiction," it reminds me of our friend Mike Wolf used to often say that judges sometimes confuse jurisdiction with authority. You will note, though, that in the last paragraph of the Supreme Court decision, the judge says to the trial court, "Now, maybe you will ultimately find that you don't have authority to do this, but you certainly have jurisdiction." So I think insofar as Missouri is concerned, we don't really know what the court is going to do. If I had to bet, I'd say they're going to wait until they see what the U.S. Supreme Court does.
Dre Cooley, who was an attorney who argued for same-sex divorce in Missouri, as part of his discussion before the Supreme Court, said Missouri can legally dissolve the marriage of same-sex couples without recognizing same-sex marriage as a whole, as the state currently does with common law marriages. Well, he ultimately prevailed because the Supreme Court sent it back.
Well, he prevailed on sort of a procedural thing.
Right, exactly.
But in that the Supreme Court, as Booker said, just said, St. Louis County Judge, you have subject matter jurisdiction over this because it involves dissolution of marriage, and that's something that courts have jurisdiction over. You might not have authority to dissolve the marriage once you actually look at it, but you can hear the case.
We'll see what the lower court has to say about that. Now let's move along to Alabama. A lot of discussion. It's almost like this issue is on a bungee cord in Alabama. Kept going back and forth and up and down. Where are we? Who can tell me where we are with regard to Alabama same-sex marriage?
Bill? Well, this is the beginning of it. So a federal judge said that ruled that Alabama's same-sex law against same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. Then the state of Alabama tried to get that effect of that ruling stayed so that marriages would not go forward. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to stay, in other words, to delay the effect of the lower court ruling throwing out the law against gay marriage. So in other words, opening the way for people to get married in Alabama. There were two dissenters to that, Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia. Then the Supreme Court, Alabama Supreme Court Judge Moore, who we sort of remember from the days of wanting to violate the First Amendment by putting the a monument to the Ten Commandments in the courthouse, ordered all the probate judges not to perform the marriages. And then the federal judge who had ruled in the beginning said, in connection with the case before that judge, that they should go ahead and conduct the marriage. It sort of reminds you of those days when courts in the South were acting as though they didn't have to pay any attention to the federal courts. But I think the overall thing that I think is sort of important to take away is that the Supreme Court keeps letting these lower court rulings throwing out same-sex marriage laws, it keeps letting them go into effect. And I cannot believe that they would let that happen if they don't see down the road that they're going to throw out same-sex marriage laws.
Do you see – Mark, I'm sorry.
Two things there. One, in an interview, he said you can dissent to the United States Supreme Court or something like that. And that's not what I learned in law school. I mean, you're supposed to follow the United States Supreme Court. You don't get to pick and choose. You, as a justice on the Supreme Court, you can dissent, but that – dissents are for losers. You didn't win. That's not what the law is. And so – that's the way it is. The other thing that's been said about the – and Bill mentioned this with Scalia and Thomas's dissent. They're kind of criticizing the court for saying basically you're already kind of saying you're going to legalize this and you shouldn't be tipping your hand like this and you should be going into that. So that got some press too. But this Moore guy's he's kind of out there.
Yeah, I think Judge Moore wants to be a politician.
Yeah, yeah.
And unfortunately, he may find that most of us as young lawyers found long ago, you do not tell federal judges that they lack authority to do something, or you could find yourself in serious trouble. And he may find himself in contempt, though this may be exactly what he wants.
Yeah. Does the dissent of Scalia and Thomas simply tell us that when this case, if and when it goes before the Supreme Court, when they rule on it, if they do, that the court obviously is going to go for same-sex marriage?
Well, I think Bill is correct. The signals are all there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would seem to be the case.
Didn't Moore get kicked off the Supreme Court and then got elected?
He got re-elected, yes.
Yeah. And he got kicked it off for not following a federal judges, yeah.
It is Alabama.
He's consistent.
let's keep that in mind. I want to move back to local prosecutor and Bob McCullough. He's got himself involved in a suit. He is suing, asking a federal judge to dismiss a suit filed by a grand juror in the Michael Brown, Darren Wilson case. Prosecutor McCullough does not want this grand juror to talk. A juror, who is it, male, female, we don't know, says McCullough did not accurately portray proceedings. Many think he should bend the rules on this because the rules were bent somewhat during that whole grand jury process. Any thoughts on that?
Well, he sort of, if you read what was submitted to, I guess this is before Judge Sippel in federal court. If you read what he submitted, he basically said this grand juror doesn't really have anything that much to worry about. Doesn't have enough to worry about to even have standing to go to the federal court and ask, an order to be able to speak about what happened in the grand jury. So McCullough's filing says there are four laws that talk about grand jury secrecy. Three of them don't have any kind of criminal penalty. The other one, the only one that does, which makes it a misdemeanor to talk about what a witness testified to or the name of a witness. And McCullough says, I already released all the testimony. And one would think that a court wouldn't want to let a grand juror identify witnesses whose names were withheld for probably good reason by the prosecutor. So what McCullough is saying is, I've already released all this information. This guy hasn't presented this man or woman. We don't know if it's a man or a woman. It's an an unnamed grand juror, hasn't really presented a case, hasn't shown you that I would prosecute him or her for saying mm-hmm. something. And so doesn't have standing. And also then he goes on to say, and this is a matter for state court, not a matter for federal mm-hmm. court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as to the particulars of this case, Bill is exactly right. I mean, it reminded me somewhat of when an individual is making a claim against a court having found the individual in contempt of court. But yet the court has – while the court has found the individual in contempt but has not entered any judgment of contempt, that is, a judgment of sentence or fine, you don't have standing until the court does that. And so the mere fact that there's a possibility that you could get prosecuted, that McCullough may choose to bring charges against the individual for revealing information that they otherwise would be prohibited from revealing, that's not going to be enough to give you standing. So I think on a legal basis, it's probably going to get kicked. But when you think about the larger picture, whatever Bill McCullough may or may not have done, I don't think it's going to change the secrecy laws regarding grand jury proceedings as a general rule.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't part of this grand juror's argument that there's this chilling effect because of the uncertainty, and that he wants to talk about public policy issues related to yeah. whether grand juries are worthwhile? And it was more than just, I want to talk to my family. I want to talk about my experience and why we should have new laws and everything. So, and I was kind of buying into that whole chilling argument there, you know, that I'd be afraid to do it.
Yeah. So the grand juror made, with the help of the ACLU, a First Amendment argument that he or she was facing a prior restraint on their speech, you know, mm-hmm. that they should be able to speak about. And the kinds of things that the grand juror wants to speak about are he or she asserts that McCullough has mischaracterized mm-hmm. the deliberations. Well, you know, McCullough wasn't present during the deliberations. Mm-hmm. That they mischaracterized the deliberations, that the legal instructions were unclear. You know, these are among the things that the grand jury
says. But he says he also wants to aid the education of the public
right.
on the grand jury and to advocate for legislative change.
Yes.
So, yeah, more than just I was mischaracterized.
Yeah.
I would have to think that Bob McCullough would like to wake up one day and find out all of this has been just a real bad dream. He certainly has been the subject of a lot of attention.
You know, day after tomorrow, he's giving an introductory speech at St. Louis University Law School. It'll be interesting to see what kind of reaction he gets.
It will be well attended, I'm sure. Of that.
Yeah, it's sold out.
You know, he's a tough guy. He's going to speak his mind and say exactly what he thinks. We all know that. That's Bob McCullough. Another subject I wanted to get to, but Bob and Kirkwood apparently has it on his mind, so let's bring him into the conversation, and he can ask my question for me. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, thank you. I don't know that I could phrase it as well as you would. But
better.
I'm curious to know your legal panel's opinion of the Texas judge that put a halt to President Obama's immigration executive order, and where they may think that will go.
All right, Booker, do you want to take that one?
Well, I have to say this kind of struck a nerve for me in the sense that it's before you get into specifics of it, you know, I'm thinking about how this judge has made statements before about his opposition to these matters. It reminded me of we have an umpire at a major league game, and he said before the game, you know, I love these Cardinals and everything they do is right and so forth and so on. I mean, we'd love to have him as an umpire, but on the other hand, could he preside over that game? And I think what happens is, you know, for our justice system to be viable, it's essential for the public to have trust in the impartiality and fairness of judges. And so this is why judges don't give opinions about things ahead of time. And so when you have what happened here, where apparently the attorneys engaged in some forum shopping to get before a judge who's already expressed an opinion about something, that creates a great deal of difficulty for me.
Hmm. Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, this judge has done a lot of speaking from the bench and put extraneous stuff in his opinion. My understanding, though, is legally he might have an argument because really isn't he talking about failure to follow the Administrative Procedure Act and not do notice and comment? Now, you know, so Obama just does it and then we get it 4 or 6 months later or something. But But yeah, there was all this extra stuff in there that didn't need to be, and I don't think reflects well on the judiciary.
And this is sort of, I mean, this is at a preliminary stage. I mean, he's saying that Obama cannot move forward on it until he's had a full trial, although he did have a 120 or 100 plus page opinion. But this isn't a decision after a trial. This is a preliminary saying, hold on. You can't move ahead. Now, I think the president has said and the attorney general have said that they are going to appeal that preliminary ruling. I guess they would first go to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and then they could potentially go to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's kind of an appeal of a temporary order goes fast. So we'll know in the next few days whether or not the appeals court or the Supreme Court will say, hey, you know, you can't do this.
A question I wanted to ask, is it on a track now that could take it to the Supreme Court? And obviously it is, Booker.
Yeah, it's going to move pretty quickly from here. As Bill said, this TRO is the kind of thing that's—
Temporary restraining order.
Yeah, is going to move pretty quickly. But obviously the judge in Texas found that there was a likelihood of success in the matter. Though I have seen where some legal scholars have argued that the states don't have any standing. It's as if they're challenging a congressional law. And that the states really don't have any ability to do that. That once there's a federal pronouncement, it is supreme, and Congress needs to deal with this.
Let me just ask you to explain something for our audience who isn't as well-versed in the law as the members of the panel here are. When we talk about standing, as we have a couple of times today, what exactly does that mean?
Standing simply means that an individual or company or corporation, plaintiff usually, the person who brings the lawsuit is not the proper person to bring that lawsuit. I mean, in its simplest terms, that's what it is. It generally does not mean that there is not a controversy or that there may not be a just claim, simply that this is the wrong person to bring
it.
It's not the best person to bring it. And that's, since our system is adversarial, you want the best person because they're going to fully litigate it.
Yeah, maybe, you know, they're not affected, or maybe they're,
right.
maybe they're not harmed. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, we may hear a little bit more about standing next month when this latest challenge to Obamacare comes up, because there's all sorts of people saying that that the people who have brought that challenge don't have any standing because they wouldn't really be affected. They're not affected.
So the president this year potentially could face terrible news from the Supreme Court on health care and also on immigration. Go ahead. After
I was just going to say that the interesting about both this immigration and the Obamacare one coming down, politically, they're great for the president. I mean, on this immigration stuff, it gives him the ability to put it back on Congress. Well, I'm getting held up by the courts. I've tried to do something. Now you do something. And the same way with the Obamacare thing, if the Supreme Court rules on that these federally created mandates aren't state created mandates, and so you can't get it, it's going to really hurt the Republican states like Missouri, the states that didn't do it. And it's gonna put real pressure on Congress to try and fix it, and the Republicans don't want to fix it, you know, because they want to eliminate it.
And you'd have several million people in the country who'd lose their health care, who
like
would be ticked off.
I think there's like 30-something states, right?
Before we get too far away from our discussion on Bob McCullough, let's take a call from Scott in Chesterfield. He wants to revive that for just a moment. We'll do that and then move on. Go ahead, Scott. You're on the air.
Since McCullough is into the letter of the law, is he going to charge witness 40 with perjury? I mean, he said he knew she was lying under oath, and he put her up there anyway. And so I'm just wondering, because this thing with the one grand juror, it does give the impression that McCullough is lying.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Yeah, that's another part of this. The whole story is the one who's not telling the truth. Thoughts?
Well, I think, as you said, Don, McCullough probably wants this all to go away. Mm-hmm. So I think it's unlikely, even if he had this juror, or witness rather, under oath and had an ironclad case of perjury, I don't think he's interested in pursuing that.
Yes, I think it's unlikely that he would file perjury charges. I mean, you have to prove a certain kind of state of mind to prove perjury. And apparently, it seems as though this witness 40 was had it would be difficult to prove that state of mind.
But he's also facing an ethics charge. And that was part of the complaint, that he suborned perjury by putting this witness on.
The question I have, though, is would he have known that this particular witness was going to lie before the lie? In other words, you know, was there a deposition? Did he know exactly what the juror was going to say and therefore allowed it to go forward? Or just learn about it later after the fact?
Well, I think he probably did know that there were questions about this person's testimony and the testimony of a number of other witnesses too, because the FBI had interviewed this witness and mm-hmm. others. And so, you know, when they put on this witness before the grand jury, they also put on, I guess it was maybe a video or an audio of the witness's interview with the FBI that demonstrated that the FBI thought that she could not have been where she claimed to have been when she observed what she said she observed. So yes, I think McCullough knew in advance, but I think he took the approach. I'm going to bring all the witnesses mm-hmm. before this grand jury, and I'm going to present, you know, in a case of witnesses whose initial statements are not borne out on the further investigation, I'm going to present the FBI interviews with those people that will show that there's questions about what they observed.
By the way, before I take the next break, point out I saw in the paper this morning Attorney General Holder indicating that the Justice Department's civil rights review of this whole case is fairly imminent, that he's going to deliver it or make the announcement himself before he leaves office, which could happen within a month or so or less.
Right. And it seems as though everything that has been leaked out of the Justice Department so far indicates that there would not be a criminal civil rights prosecution against Darren Wilson. But, you know, they also have this pattern or practice investigation underway, which is a civil case, which is, you know, is there a pattern or practice of unconstitutional behavior by the Ferguson authorities? And most likely, my guess would be that he would put those two things together. You know, we're not going to proceed on the criminal, but look, here's what we're doing on this pattern and practice.
Well, it should be relatively soon. We'll find out. Have to take a break. We'll do that now, then continue with our legal roundtable panel. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll continue with our legal roundtable discussion in just a moment. First, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Law enforcement groups say public access and retention of footage from police cameras should be limited to protect privacy and contain costs. A Missouri Senate committee heard today from police groups who support a bill limiting the release of footage collected by officers. Protesters have called for increased use of body cameras by police after the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a Ferguson police officer. Governor Bruce Rauner is unveiling his proposal for dealing with Illinois' deficit at this hour in Springfield. The Republican is giving his first budget address, which was expected to include an increase in state money for schools, but cuts to most other areas. And Governor Jay Nixon met with several students at Roosevelt High in St. Louis today to discuss the Jobs for America's Graduates, or JAG, program. The program has been used at several Missouri high schools to keep at-risk students in school to earn their degrees and move into the workforce or higher education. The governor is a member of JAG's National Board of Directors. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Well, while the subject of police cameras is fresh in the headlines, let's talk about that for a moment. An issue popped up, I guess it was earlier this week, when an officer was shown on video warning other officers struggling with a suspect that the cameras were on. Are there any rules yet about that, when they turn the cameras on and off? I mean, this was at the heat of a confrontation.
Well, what I read in the Post-Dispatch was that there are the special orders of the police department say that the camera has to remain on. And I take it that's one of the reasons that they dropped the potential criminal prosecution of the person arrested was because they had violated that rule. There does seem to be a big controversy, you know, as your story you just read indicates, on whether this the video of these stops should be public or not. And I see the Attorney General, Missouri Attorney General Koster, has said it should not be. I went earlier in the fall. I went over to Cincinnati to see how they've tried to deal with problems they had in police community relations after a young man was killed there in 2001. And one of the main things that they do is they make sure that the video of any kind of a shooting is released right away, you know, within 12 or 20 hours, in addition to the name of the shooter. And that has created a great deal of trust in the Cincinnati community that didn't exist before. And I think that, I think St. Louisans should think about how things worked in Cincinnati.
Yeah. By the same token, if you're involved in a domestic dispute and the cops come in and the cameras are rolling, you don't want that video to ever show up anyplace. Any thoughts, Mark?
Yeah, but if I'm involved in a domestic dispute, there's a police report. The newspaper can get that police report. And so I'm with Bill on this one. I think those videos should be... They're part of the public record.
There was a police report also on the football player who knocked out his wife in the elevator. Mm-hmm. You know, the police report reads a lot differently than that video reads, if I can put it that way.
Right.
Yeah, I understand the officer who turned off the camera here is under some discipline, in fact, for doing that. So the police department does have rules about that. And so the debate is whether it should be a closed record or a public record. So I was interested, Bill, in finding out what they do in Cincinnati. And you're right, police reports are redacted very little and released to the public.
I have had limited experience with the police officers, but when I was on the police board, I would go on ride-alongs all the time. And what I saw was people, you know, being really nasty to the police and very and the police would just have to take it and, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but this is what I can do." And I think these cameras are going to help the police officers. I really do think that. Now, once in a while, there's something really bad, but I think, you know, if I'm in a meeting with somebody at work and my boss is in the room, I'm much nicer. I'm always much nicer because I'm just know that that's there, and that's what that camera is going to force everyone to be on best behavior, and that's what we want.
You know, in a past life, I was involved in police training, and time after time, the police officers said, "We want these cameras." We're talking about the cruiser cameras primarily, because you go to court, and it's often a he said, she said situation. This proves it. If you're right, of course, if they've done something wrong, it's a different story. But most of the time, 99.9% of the time or more, they're in the right, and this is an issue that helps protect them, as you say.
You know, the FBI Director Comey gave an interesting speech last week, where he talked about the need for a real change in law enforcement's approach. And, you know, one of the things he said in there was that video cameras are not going to solve the problem. You know, there really needs to be sort of a much more sort of institutional reform in the relationship between police and civilians. And that was a really interesting speech that he gave.
Well, you brought us back to the national level. Let me bring in another story that is interesting for a lot of reasons. That is a bipartisan proposal on Capitol Hill to revise the mandatory minimums in federal sentencing to ease overcrowding in prisons. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is a big part of that. The fact that it was a bipartisan agreement is really sort of interesting in and of itself. I guess, Booker, you're shaking your head. The overcrowding situation does need to be dealt with somehow. This may be the way to do it.
Well, I think this perhaps has been the one thing that has brought it to a boil. But it's a little bit annoying to know that for decades on the bench, judges and those of us in the profession have seen reports from the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice indicating this problem is coming. This problem is here. Oftentimes, we would see reports from wardens all over the country, and these are not soft-on-crime people who say this so-called war on drugs is not solving anything. You're giving people these huge sentences for nonviolent crimes, not giving them any kind of training, only how to be better criminals, and they go back into the street, and of course, recidivism is up. So I'm happy to see this. I know the federal judges have been really unhappy about being hamstrung for many, many years. My brother, of course, has been one of the most outspoken about this issue. But many of the federal judges came from the state bench, where you have ranges of punishment, but yet the judge has the opportunity to take into consideration the specific circumstances of the case. Federal judges for years have been prohibited from doing that and had to give mandatory minimum sentences no matter what the circumstances of the case, oftentimes for relatively petty crimes.
And who would your brother be, for those in the audience who don't know?
Charles Shaw. Yeah, yeah.
Fairly well known in this, in this community. All right, any other thoughts on that?
Just that it has support from Democrats to Tea Party members, so this might actually pass.
Yeah, that's rare.
It's nice to see them working together.
Rare, as we all know. Yeah. Okay, while we're talking about incarceration, is it too strong a term, as 11 attorneys, I think, representing the American Civil Liberties Union, who are suing Ferguson, claiming that the jails in Ferguson are, in fact, debtors' prisons. That takes us back to this whole issue of fines and fees, which we've been hearing so much about. What do you think, Bill? Are jails in these munis debtors' prisons?
Well, yeah, I think actually they can sometimes end up like that. I mean, it's I've really been convinced, you know, talking to people like Thomas Harvey at Arch City Defenders, that even though a lot of the practices, the legal practices that are followed in these municipal courts, even though many of them are on their face not really discriminatory, they just issue bench warrants for somebody who doesn't appear in court, that the impact of them on poor people, and particularly when you might get a bench warrant in a couple of different adjacent municipalities and end up getting locked up in those in more than one holdover, can be really destructive to poor people's lives. And, you know, the people are ending up in prison for not being able to pay their fines. So, yeah, is that a debtor prison? It sort of is.
I think they're alleging that this is a constitutional. Is it the constitutionally cruel and unusual punishment? Is that where they're going with this?
Well, it's lack of due process as well. Because what happens is it's incumbent upon the court to determine the individual's ability to pay. If you don't do that, it's a debtor prison. Mm-hmm. So if an individual is unable to pay, has no income, he's either unemployed, on disability, or for whatever reason, and the judge does not even make that inquiry and simply says, you have a $1,000 fine, you don't pay it, I'm locking you up. It's a debtor prison.
They're also arguing inadequate counsel, the cruel and unusual punishment, but mainly, like you said, due process under equal protection.
This will be a most interesting one to watch, and this is getting a lot of attention from a lot of different angles as well.
Politico just reported this morning that one of the actions the Justice Department may take as part of that pattern or practice investigation that I mentioned a few minutes ago may be aimed at this very situation, the municipalities like Ferguson keeping and ending up locking up people for not paying fines.
The U.S. Supreme Court is taking a look at Oklahoma's execution protocol, and we're all familiar with the botched execution down there several months ago. One of the things that caught my eye is the reason is that whatever the court does with this, it will have an impact here in Missouri. Why is that?
Well, I think one of the issues in the Oklahoma case is whether or not the person on death row, if he's going to challenge the drug protocol for execution, whether he has to be able to come up with a less cruel and unusual way to get executed. And that is what the Court of Appeals here in St. Louis, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, has said in connection with Missouri people on death row, that you can't even challenge this. You can't really challenge this drug protocol unless you can show us a constitutional way to execute you. So, which is sort of an can be sort of an impediment to a person on death row. So, but then, you know, on the other hand, you know, we've had an execution since the Supreme Court decided to hear this. We've had an execution in Missouri since the Supreme Court decided to hear the Oklahoma case on the drug protocol. So, I guess it's not going to stop executions. Although I think the Attorney General Holder said yesterday, when he was before the press club, I think, that he thought there really should be a national moratorium while the Supreme Court on executions, mm-hmm. while the Supreme Court figured out this Oklahoma case.
I have an email here from Tom in Afton who writes, speaking of policing How big of an issue is it that Missouri's use of force law for police is apparently unconstitutional, and that 6 months after Brown's death, there seems to be no real movement towards it being corrected? Bill, I'll come back to you, because you've written about use of force and what's going on in the legislature. Quickly, time's getting away.
Right.
What's your review?
Well, this was part of the confusion before the grand jury, in that McCullough's prosecutors initially told the grand jury in the Ferguson case that they should follow the Missouri law, which basically allows police to use force to capture a fleeing felon. Then they changed the instruction at the very last minute to say, no, you know, you got to pay attention to what the U.S. Supreme Court says, which is you can't use deadly force to shoot a fleeing felon who is non-dangerous and unarmed. Now, there are some bills before the Missouri legislature to try to change Missouri's law so that police would have less authority to use deadly force to just capture a fleeing felon. But all of those I've talked to Chad Flanders and Marcia McCormick, who have been we've talked to before on this program, who say that there are flaws in all of those bills before the Missouri legislature. So hopefully the Missouri legislature will take this seriously, but won't make things worse in the way they do it.
So I see eyes rolling here. We'll move on. Time is getting away. Our friend Dave Rowland, who was on this program on many occasions in the past before he moved away, he's with the Freedom Center of Missouri. He's concerned because third-party candidates are not being allowed to run in a forthcoming county council special election in St. Louis County. It is the law. It's within the law. But the question is it constitutional? A candidate who is not being allowed to run is filing suit. What do you think, Mark?
Right. Well, I think they entered into a consent judgment.
They did.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they basically said they're going to allow this candidate to
oh,
be
really?
On the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge said, and this is before Judge White, that they're not deciding the question of whether the statute is unconstitutional. They said the issue is not moot and still before the court for a resolution. So because it's capable of repetition. So I think this is not over. She's on the ballot as the Constitution Party candidate, and this is for Stanger's old seat. But they're going to decide whether this part of the county, I guess it's the county charter, is unconstitutional.
When did this happen? I missed that entirely. I have to confess.
I don't have a date on mine. So this, probably in the last couple of days.
Yeah, it was very recently done, last day or two.
Yeah.
How is a law like this written? I mean, it just seems to me it's so exclusionary. It's just
some would say it's arbitrary.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Really?
That only the top two candidates in the previous election, their parties would be allowed on the ballot. So it may have some problems.
But think about what we do with the presidential debates. We don't let every candidate in, you know. So it may not seem unreasonable when they were doing it, because you don't see the Constitution Party candidate for president up there with Romney and Obama. It's just, let's take the top two. And occasionally we'll throw in a Ross Perot for fun.
Well, those are the debates as opposed to the elections.
Well, that's exactly right.
We only have a minute left, probably not enough time to talk about this, but the Missouri legislature, once again, is dealing with this fines and fees issues. And one of the things they're considering is if these fines and fees in terms of total revenue aren't capped at 10% throughout the state of Missouri, then they will have the provision in there to dissolve the municipalities who don't comply. How does that strike you?
Well, it strikes me as the kind of thing that may result in some of these municipalities reconsidering not only their fine structure, but whether they can continue to exist. Though the 10%, I don't think it's an across-the-board. And so far as the legislation I've seen now, I think it's at 20%.
Well, no, I think they were talking 10%, but weren't they going to give you an extra 5% if you had a major interstate going through?
Oh, okay.
I think their work is still working on it.
One thing I think that's of concern is whether or not this will end up if it ends up eliminating a lot of the municipalities that are relying on this revenue, it could have the unintended consequence. Jason Rosenbaum wrote about this last week. Could have the unintended consequence of eliminating a lot of the black municipal leaders in North St. Louis County. So I think people really need to pay attention to how what this legislation actually says.
These unintended consequences, they can jump up and really bite you. We've got to end it there. I want to thank you so much, gentlemen, for being with us. Booker T. Shaw, great to see you again. Thank you so much for being with us. You always are a valuable participant, as is Bill Freivogel. Thank you, Bill, for being with us. And Mark Smith, another valuable participant.
Well, that's very nice of you.
Thank you all. That's our legal roundtable panel. We'll see you again in about a month. And tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about eating disorders and efforts to raise awareness of them as a serious complex illness. We'll also talk with U.S. Representative Mike Bost of Illinois' 12th District. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.